There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19.
Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this podcast.
Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. As always, so glad that you could gather around the card table. Perhaps you were lucky enough to grab some 2021 Top Series 1 packs as they went on sale to hobby stores just a few days ago. And whether it's the new stuff, the old stuff, even if it's gold stuff, it's still rock and roll to me, or something like that. All apologies to Billy Joel on that. But whether you're collecting the new stuff, you're revisiting some of the stuff from your teenage years, or you're venturing out and buying some vintage stuff. Stuff, of course, being classic cardboard. And we will have some classic cardboard conversation on today's program as well, as we dabble into the 90s nostalgia once again. Good Lord, 90s nostalgia is full range. I mean, just going on at 150% these days, isn't it? 90s nostalgia, it's raging through this nation like the hormones of a 14-year-old. And if you recall those days, God bless you, you made it through it. But, you know, even looking at Super Bowl commercials, man, you're seeing some of the artists from the 90s. You know, Shaggy was in a commercial. You could argue that Ashton Kutcher and Mila Kunis are also 90s actors from that 70s show, of course. You know, I'm thinking of that Cheetos spot. And there's you know, the Pizza Hut's doing the throwback logo, and you know, everyone is just swimming in 90s right now. And we're going to jump into the 90s pool once more with a look at 1994 Donruss, an outstanding set that is a bargain bin beauty these days, because not only was there a lot of it made, but due to mostly a very light rookie class, there's just so much of it still out there. It's very affordable, but it's a pretty sharp set. And while I have lauded the changes that were made, the upgrades that were made to the 1992 and 93 Donruss sets, which we've discussed in previous podcasts, 1994, as sharp of a, you know, set as it was, there were so many factors working against it. Of course, the baseball strike in 1994, and also the hobby just bulging at the seams, about to explode into obscurity in the mid-90s. And when I say explode, I don't mean that positive explosion of awareness and people jumping on board. I mean the Mr. Creosote explosion, you know, the character from Monty Python's The Meaning of Life, who has just a little too much to eat, and he finally explodes with the wafer thin mint given by the waiter, portrayed by John Cleese. And, you know, that was working against Donruss, but also Donruss was shooting itself in the foot in 1994. And even though it was a pretty sharp set, there were some, things done, some lax oversight, and just some carelessness, some laziness in the 1994 set that laid to waste a pretty good, valiant effort to revive and strengthen the base set. But having to compete against itself with the premium sets from Leaf and Ultra, and Studio, but also having to compete with other premium sets such as Ultra from Fleer and Flair and Pinnacle and Stadium Club and all the other base sets that were basically premium sets, it just got swallowed up. And it was a sign of things to come, not just in the hobby, but also for Donruss, which would just fall flat on its face just a few years later, and very much the poster child of the excessive hobby that became the baseball card hobby in the mid-1990s there. So there are some positives of the 94 Donruss set. We'll go through it, and most of the positives are now in 2021. You can get some great bargains on the set, and it is a very nice set, but you have to deal with some of the relatively minor headaches that come with many of the sets that were produced in 1994. So we'll talk about that later on. Also get you up to speed on some of the players that we pulled from the packs. I had two Series 2 packs that I opened up on YouTube yesterday. If you didn't see the link on our Twitter handle at Wax and Gum Stains, just go to YouTube. And I have rebranded the YouTube page, by the way. It's a little difficult because I started posting these videos to my personal Matt Salmon YouTube account, or Gmail account, I guess they're all interlaced. But I wanted to rename it Wax Ecstatic. The problem is, because it's my personal Gmail account, you know, now it's showing me as Wax Ecstatic and not Matt Salmon, although one can be kind of, you know, the other. You know, we do kind of trade off personalities here. So if you type in my name, Matt Salmon, on YouTube, or Wax Ecstatic, you'll see instead of my smiling mug in the picture, the avatar, you'll see the Wax Ecstatic logo there. Just some of the changes that we're making to the YouTube page. But anyways, if you go to the Wax Ecstatic YouTube page, or if you type in 1994 Donruss, Wax Ecstatic 1994 Donruss Series 2 Pack Break, you'll see what we found. And we'll update you on a few players, what they're doing now, how they got to big league prominence in 1994. A couple pitchers and a couple of hitters. It just worked out that way. As we'll be taking a look at Andy Benes, also Todd Van Poppel, the poster child of rookie card excess from the early 1990s. I've got a great story of Todd Van Poppel. You may have heard one of the many great what-ifs of Major League Baseball. And there are many what-if stories when it comes to amateur drafts at any sport. You know, what if, you know, 15 other teams took a chance at Patrick Mahomes, you know, in the NFL draft a few years ago? Of course, Tom Brady, sixth round pick, 2000. We all know that story. And the Todd Van Poppel what if is phenomenal, because it would have altered not just Todd Van Poppel's career potentially, but also an entire organization. And I'll get to that in a moment. A couple other players that we'll be talking about: Eddie Murray, who gets overlooked often, which is unfortunate because he's kind of in the same mold as the late Willie McCovey, where by all accounts, a gentle giant who could just murder a ball into right field. He was a terror and arguably one of the best first basemen, not just in the modern era of Major League Baseball, but you could even say, you know, since the dead ball era in the last 100 years, offensively and defensively. And another hyped name, much in the same vein as Todd Van Poppel, however, he did have a slightly more productive career, Ryan Klesko. He was another big rookie card chase back around 92, 93. And if you pulled a Ryan Klesko card out of your 1994 Donruss pack, it was probably worth about 50 cents right out of the pack, which was pretty big deal back then. Nowadays, I don't know if there's a card worth 50 cents in 94 Donruss, but we'll talk about those four players. Those were all cards that we pulled from the two packs. And again, you can watch that video if you haven't already. Go to YouTube, type in Wax Ecstatic 1994 Donruss Series 2 Pack Break and see what we discovered. Now, as I mentioned, you know, I am doing a little bit of a facelift to the YouTube page. It is still my personal page, but we've slathered Wax Ecstatic all over it. So if you don't mind, subscribe to the YouTube channel, please, and tell all of your collecting friends to subscribe as well. As of now, I'm just going to continue to, you know, post the videos every other week, leading into our podcast, kind of a, you know, a tease as to what we're going to be talking about. But perhaps eventually, as the podcast continues, there may be some more video elements. I don't know. It's becoming pretty obvious to me that this rather random just bored out of my mind project that I started 4.5-5 years ago is starting to have a little more traction. I've noticed YouTube subscribers jumping up recently, more Twitter followers. I think I owe a lot of that to the pandemic, as we've mentioned before, and also 90s nostalgia. That's a big part of it. But during the pandemic, a lot of people bored out of their minds, just started rummaging through baseball card collections and just going back to childhood memories and using the pandemic as a pretty good excuse to get back into collecting, because it took your mind off of all the stress and the sadness that was going on, especially, you know, last spring and summer. You know, I've seen these numbers pop up recently with YouTube and Twitter followers. So I'm looking at kind of growing the podcast and kind of growing the Wax Ecstatic thing, you know, whatever it is, the Wax Ecstatic following. It is a small but hearty bunch here. It's kind of like public radio. You know, it's not a mass appeal product, but for those of you who like it, you really like it. And I thank you very much for liking it. So please continue to share Wax and Gum Stains, the Twitter timeline, with your friends. Continue to subscribe and tell your friends to subscribe to the YouTube channel. And continue to rate and review the podcast if you have that ability on whatever platform you're listening to. Remember, all positive reviews are greatly appreciated. All negative reviews will be mocked. Yes, you will be made fun of right here on the program. Consider it an honor, not an insult. Or you can consider it an insult, and I don't care. Now, the next couple of podcasts we're really excited about here, because I'm going to be talking some repacked wax in our next podcast. Yes, as we're wrapping up the 90s nostalgia look here with the 1994 Donruss this time around, 2 weeks from now, that will be Friday, February 26th, we'll have a conversation with Ryan Cornell of Repacked Wax. And I'm really excited about this, not only because Repacked Wax is a great idea. It's come together over the last couple of years, where Ryan and his fellow creators at Repacked Wax wanted to recreate the excitement of getting the waxed pack, okay, not the tamper-resistant cellophane or foil wrapping that we have today. No, the good old-fashioned wax wrapping that left a big fat stain on the pack of cards. We want to relive that, right? The good old days in the 70s and the 80s. Well, Ryan and company formed Repacked Wax, were able to not only get those wax packages, but also were able to collect thousands of vintage baseball cards. And we're talking stuff from, say, the early 90s all the way back through the 1960s. And we're not just talking about just junk that's in a bargain bin. You know, the stuff, the stray cards that I buy. You know, hey, here's a 1966 Pete Rose. Sure, it's got, you know, some major damage on the corners and a nice fat crease down the middle, but I got it for $2. Okay. So, you know, it's not that. If you're going to find a 1966 Topps card in repacked wax, it's going to be in pretty good condition. So it's a labor of love, but also a fantastic idea that is very popular with collectors, a little too popular in some cases. You've got some hoarders who are trying to corner the market on that. But we're going to talk to Ryan about how repacked wax came about, how they're dealing with the tremendous success that it has become, and how they're trying to combat the hoarders. You know, you're trying to reach the quote-unquote common collector with this. You don't want hoarders buying boxes and boxes of these and just sitting on them for 10 or 20 years, much like the pack chase boxes that came out several years ago. And I mentioned this in the last podcast. You remember those where there were the randomly inserted 1952 Topps packs, or, you know, older vintage packs. And they were often inserted around the 88 Donruss and the other packs that we'd rather forget about. Well, you had collectors who were buying these by the case and just storing them away. And now they're trying to resell them, you know, up from the $20 or $30, you know, retail price that was suggested. So, you know, how do you combat that? So I'm looking forward to talking to Ryan about that. And funny story about Ryan. As I was arranging this phone interview a couple weeks ago, we were chatting back and forth on Twitter DM. I discovered, in fact, we actually both discovered, that we have perhaps crossed paths before and in the most amazing way. And that is, to make a very long story short, we discovered that we both lived in the same small suburb of Tampa about 40 years ago, early 80s, around 82, 83, I believe he said. And we both attended the same church. That is just, I mean, what a small world. You know, it's one thing to go, oh, I used to live in Tampa, or, you know, I used to live near there. But as we started talking, we discovered that we grew up just a couple miles apart. Like I said, we went to the same church, and it was a pretty big church. But, you know, still, we went to the same church, and at the time, because we're the same age, we would have been 4 or 5 years old. So, you know, my memories are pretty fuzzy about a lot of things from that age, and I only remember certain people and certain events. It's just amazing that these two people who are connected through the hobby and who have never spoken to one another before, at least that we know of, you know, we grew up in the same town of a couple miles apart, went to the same church, probably knew the same people, you know, 6 degrees of separation nearly 40 years ago. And that's just kind of mind blowing and fun, too. So I don't think we'll bore you with any stories of the Nativity Catholic Church November Fest from 1982. But it's kind of neat to know that we have that bond, and we continue to have a bond through collecting cards all these years later. So Ryan Cornell of Repacked Wax, that is coming up in a couple of weeks, Friday, February 26th. Also upcoming, not necessarily in this order, just letting you know of a couple of topics that we'll be talking about, updated and rookie card sets, traded sets. So, you know, kind of the high series sets, which started in the 1970s with Topps and became a pretty big thing in the mid 1980s. We'll talk about that. Also, foodstuffs. I'm collecting little sets here and there, the Squirt Soda cards from the early 1980s, trying to track down some Topps Burger King cards. Those were very big in the late 70s and early 80s. In fact, Topps ran full sets, you know, 726 card sets, parallel sets that were co-opted with Burger King. So I'm trying to track down, if not packs, at least a lot of cards. So we'll be talking about some foodstuff cards from about 40 or so years ago from Squirt and also Burger King. And we'll see if there's a couple others that we pull in from around that time. That's a unique subset of the hobby that a lot of collectors like. And also, as I mentioned in the last show, we're going to reach out to our good friend Nick Deonte, who's not only celebrating the release of Top Series 1 this past week, but who's got his finger on the pulse of the hobby and everything that Topps is putting out. He is a influencer, a reviewer for the Topps company, so he gets a lot of these products before they hit the market. Looking forward to talking to Nick. We'll also time that with the release of Topps Heritage, which will be looking back at 1972 Topps. So we'll take a look at 72 Topps, which is a pivotal set. A lot of people overlook the 72 Topps set just because it does have a very gaudy, although memorable design, very similar to the 75 Topps set. But in 72, there were some things that were done with the set that were pretty ground shaking for Topps. They were, you know, trying to you know, shake up the static appearance of baseball cards, and not just with a, you know, crazy trippy design, but also especially with photography, how they were dealing with photography and especially action shots in the game. Now, they would go overboard with action shots in the 1973 set, but 1972 was a turning point because the market for baseball cards, the audience was changing, not necessarily in demographics, that would eventually come around a few years later, but in the early 70s, think about it, you know, a 12 or 13 year old who was collecting baseball cards in 1972 was a completely different person from a 12 or 13 year old who was collecting in 1962 or 1952. So there were some notable changes in the set in 1972 that you would see reverberated throughout the 1970s, and there are still some things that are part of baseball cards today, you know, action shots especially, but also just some little changes that were made to the set in 1972 that became big changes in the hobby moving forward. And you never know what'll come up. I may find something at a local card shop or through a cardboard donation, or I may just find something that blows me away on eBay that I have to buy where I go, yep, we got to talk about that. So you never know what's going to come up here on Wax Ecstatic. One last bit of housekeeping before we talk about 94 Donruss. You heard me mention cardboard donations. I've been receiving those, some for the show. Thank you very much. I've been inspired to talk about certain products because of your cardboard donations. So if you would like to make a cardboard donation, email me first. Tell me what you're thinking. MattSammonSays@gmail.com. That's M-A-T-T. SAMMONSEZ at gmail.com. And let me know what you're thinking of sending. And if you want me to cover shipping and handling, or if you just want to make it a total free donation, that's fine. Just let me know. Don't just deliver it to me. Tell me what you're sending first. But also, I want to thank a lot of listeners. And too many to name here individually. There were about 8 or 10 of you who stepped up. But over the last few weeks, I've been able to complete my hand-collated 84, 85, and 86 top sets. So for those of you who make cardboard donations just on my personal account, thank you very much. I've completed 84 through 86. So now in terms of hand-collated sets, I've got, and this is just tops, 84 through 91 done. I am, how many cards? 22 cards away from 1977 tops being complete. So that'll be my next call out. If you happen to have some 77 tops, including some star cards, let me know. I am not a stickler for condition. Obviously, I don't want something that's been through the washing machine a few times. But if you have a few 77 tops cards laying around, I will pay for them or I'll work on a trade. Let me know, DM me at Wax and Gum Stains, and we'll figure it out. Also, cash donations, always appreciated. PayPal.me/WaxEcstatic. Send me, even if it's $5, it goes a long, long way in this program. And don't forget, all excess donations or excess products from donations. So let's say we purchase a box of cards and we've got 300 cards that I just don't want sitting around here. They go to the Commons for Kids cause. You can follow them on Twitter at Commons for Kids. That's the number 4. They collect older cards, even newer cards, not just sports, non-sports as well, but they'll take all sports. It's not just baseball, and they will deliver these cards to kids who are in need, kids who are dealing with financial issues at home, perhaps bad family situations or medical issues, kids fighting cancer, any kid who needs a pick-me-up. There's, in my opinion, no better way to pick up a kid's spirits, especially if they're a sports fan, than just delivering some cards. Gives them something to look at. They can relate to the players, their favorite teams, you name it. And it just takes their mind off, even if it's just for a few minutes, from whatever crap they're dealing with in their life. So keep that in mind. All donations, be it cash or cardboard, it trickles to the great people like Commons for Kids. And certainly you can make donations direct to them. Again, follow them, Commons for Kids on Twitter, for information on where you can send your cards to. All right, 1994 Donruss, an outstanding set in terms of star quality, overall card quality as well. But this was the set that showed that Donruss had jumped the shark. And it wasn't just Donruss. There were other sets that were falling by the wayside, especially the base sets for many of these companies. But 1994 was kind of the point of no return for the hobby at that point in time and for certain card companies. And Donruss was definitely one of those card companies. We all know the history of Donruss, the surprise entrant into the hobby in 1981. Fleer was doing all the court battles. Once Fleer won in the summer of 1980, Fleer and Donruss come in, provide some much-needed competition for tops, and much needed revenue for Major League Baseball and the Major League Baseball Players Association. And that's what started the growth of the hobby into a business when the Players Association and Major League Baseball realized, hey, we've got a good relationship with Topps, but we can make a crap ton more money if we continue to offer licenses to other companies, then this is good for business. And that's how Score came around in Sportsflix and Bowman and Upper Deck and you name it and all the premium sets. Well, by 1994, Donruss had completed its much needed restoration to the base set. Donruss creating some great sets in the mid to late 80s, falling flat on its face in 1990, coming up with an okay but not great set in 1991, needing to respond in 1992. And they did, as we've discussed in previous podcasts, coming up with a base set that had a lot of premium look to it. Arguably, you could say was the best set that Donruss produced, or you could argue, and I would make this argument, 1993 Donruss was the best because they managed to improve upon 1992. It was the largest offering that Donruss had at the time, a 792 card set. So in 1993, equaling what Topps was producing for many, many years in terms of card count, and Donruss was still putting out some cards that had a nice gloss to it, featured some A-plus photography, reimagined the backs of the cards from kind of the static, boring card back that they had used for much of the 80s and into the early 90s. And they were in the insert mania as well. You know, Donruss Diamond Kings became an insert card. You had special league leader cards that, were featured. You had autograph cards as well. So Donruss, even though producing a great set in 1993, starting to kind of fall down the rabbit hole that every other card maker was going through at that time, where you had to have, refractors and inserts and autographs and game used memorabilia and parallel sets. And it just started going down that hole pretty quickly. And you see that in 1994, where Donruss produces a great set. The borderless cards, they finally got rid of the border in 1994, like many card companies had done. And really, the card company that did that first was Top Stadium Club in 1991. Everyone following suit by then, even Upper Deck was making borderless cards by then. So Donruss gets on board in 1994. Great action photography. I love the backs of 94 Donruss cards because you've got a full action shot on the back. The player information, the little bio box is kind of small and off to the side. A little hard to read because Donruss was using a black box with a dark gold typeface. So it's a little difficult to read. You got to squint a little bit. And Donruss also shelving the recent major league stats and going in favor of the previous year's stats and a career stat line. And that was it. So the back of the card, very similar to the front, very similar to, you know, how Stadium Club was designed in 1991 and would continue to look in 1992 and 93. So Donruss with the base set had pretty much caught up with everybody else in terms of look and feel with the premium look and feel to the base set. Now, that's the good side. The downside is that Donruss on the fronts of the card is still needing to brand itself. You kind of have a big fat Donruss logo on top of the team logo, so that's a little distracting, but that's an aesthetic thing, right? Well, the other downsides are the usual downsides to baseball cards that were made in 1994, talking mostly about UV coating. Yes, there was a nice gloss to the cards, but in some cases, depending on how the cards were stored over the years, the cards would stick to one another. Now, Donruss's UV coating, I've noticed this, did not stick as much as Upper Decks or Top Stadium Club at the time. So Donruss, I don't know what kind of chemical combination they used, but it was not as strong of a UV coating. I remember opening up Upper Deck and Top Stadium Club cards in 1993 and getting a headache from them. It was just such a strong chemical smell. Well, now, nearly 30 years later, you still have the smell and the cards stick to one another, which is definitely a bad thing. So not quite as bad as Upper Deck and Stadium Club. However, Donruss UV coating, you do have a little bit of stickiness with one card to the other. Also a big issue with 94 Donruss, and this is part aesthetics, but also just one of the headaches of cards that were produced at the time. Gold. Gold, 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 gold. Ark Goldfinger from the James Bond movie would be thrilled with all the gold foil that was just oozing from 1994 Donruss. And again, they're not the only company that was doing this. You know, Fleer Ultra was covered in gold. Top Stadium Club was covered in gold foil. The Topps base set was not only covered in gold, but black gold. There was gold in all them hills in 1994. And there is just gold foil slathered on everything in the 1994 Donruss set. So while that makes for some pretty fancy cards, it also makes for some pretty hard-to-read cards, especially the parallel set, which I'll get into a little more detail in just a moment. So that could be headache inducing as well. If it wasn't the smell of the cards and the UV coating, it was trying to read through the gold foil of some of these parallel cards in the 94 set. On top of the aesthetic issues, such as big logos and also the foil cards, again, you have the insert mania. So you've got the Diamond King inserts. Rated Rookies, which used to be just kind of in one little pocket of the base set, were scattered all throughout the set. So it was a little harder to collect those if you wanted to. Now, there were some pretty neat inserts. As I mentioned, the parallel set was a pretty smart idea from Donruss because it created a chase card, but it also watered down, or I shouldn't say watered down, it boiled down the 660 card base set into basically the top 100 cards of the set. And with the parallel set, you had a whole new look to some of the top stars that were in Major League Baseball at that time. And it created a pretty neat gold foil parallel set to chase. And we did get a couple of those parallel cards, Don Mattingly and Jeff Bagwell. So, you know, a couple of big stars there, a Hall of Famer and a guy who should be in the Hall of Fame. And, you know, the parallel set is actually pretty neat, but you can imagine if you're chasing these down, not only do you have the 660 base cards plus the Donruss Diamond King insert set, now you're chasing down this subset, and that could be a little nauseating, especially considering the plethora of options that were out in the market in 1994. Now, another neat insert set, which still carries some ripple effect of today. The 1994 Donruss set decided to pay homage to the 1984 Donruss set. And if you study the history of baseball cards, you will remember that 84 Donruss was the first really good Donruss set. It had the right design. It had much better photography than its three predecessors. It also had the Don Mattingly rookie card, and you had second-year cards of some of the biggest young stars in the league, namely Ryan Sandberg, Tony Gwynn, and Wade Boggs. Plus, it finally, you know, raised the bar of the competition against Topps. And, of course, Fleer was following a similar path. They had a pretty good release in 1984 as well. So Donruss decided to honor the 84 set in 1994, the 10th anniversary of that set, with 10 cards that were reprinted. So you had these 10 cards that were glossier, that had a little bit of a gold foil effect to the Donruss wave at the bottom of the 84 set. And those were randomly inserted. Now, while I've often bemoaned the insert card mania that was happening in 1994, this is pretty unique because, to the best of my recollection, this would have been the first time that you had reprinted cards from past sets being inserted into a current set. Now, that is different from what Topps was doing in 1991. In 1991, they were randomly inserting older cards in honor of the 40th anniversary of Topps creating baseball cards. So that's different. That's just taking old cards and randomly inserting them. This was a reprint of select cards from 1984 that were gussied up a little bit to have the 1994 look and feel with the glossiness and the gold foil wave. And that was a nice way of tying in the old with the new. That is something, if you collect any of the cards that have been produced in the past few years by Topps, that is something that Topps is doing now ad nauseum. You know, they were inserting reprints of cards using like the 1987 design or the 1983 design, you know, some of their popular designs. And that was one of the big inserts and parallel sets that was driving the ridiculous sales of the 2020 top sets. A lot of star players and star rookies having their cards reprinted in the 1985 style. Guess what? You're going to see that in 2021. They're going to throw it back to 1986. So, and I can imagine, I don't have full details on what Topps is doing with the 2021 set, but considering this is the 70th anniversary of Topps baseball cards, you can bet that there will be plenty of glossy reprints, slightly different color variations of past cards that will be plugged into the 2021 base set. And that's what Donruss was doing in 1994. So even though the 94 Donruss set is overlooked, underappreciated, often forgotten about, they did do something that, again, I think gets overlooked in the grand timeline of baseball cards, creating these reprint cards, touching them up a little bit to make them current, and tying in the old with the new and creating a fantastic margin market of people chasing these cards and their variations. So the people at Topps may not want to acknowledge it, but 1994 Donruss did it with their acknowledgement to some of the key cards from the 1984 Donruss set. Now, you heard me mention that Donruss created a 660 card base set that is noticeably down from their high of 792 cards from 1993. So in 93, they matched Topps with what Topps had been producing through 1992. The 93 Topps set was, of course, larger because of the addition of the Florida Marlins and Colorado Rockies. But Donruss decided to scale it back to 660 cards. That was the size of the Donruss set throughout much of their early existence into the early 1990s. And they not only shortened the size of the base set, but they also shortened the number of cards, or reduced the number of cards that were printed, for a couple of reasons. One, because the hobby was getting so bloated, you started seeing companies doing reduced print runs on certain sets, and especially the base sets, because by 1994, while fans were collecting base sets, many collectors were moving on to premium sets. So there was a little less attention paid to the base set for Donruss. But at the same time, it also reduced the supply of it for the hopes of reinvigorating the demand for it. So maybe collectors weren't clamoring for the Donruss set. They were going out for the Leaf and the studio sets. But by publishing far fewer cards, they at Donruss were hoping that you could at least pump up the market value of some of these base cards, even if the demand for them just from general collectors was not that high. So they were trying to strike that balance with the 660 card set. And the problem that Donruss had was, by reducing the number of cards and the print run for the base set, you were kind of doing a backhanded acknowledgement that people were abandoning the base set, despite some of the, you know, tremendous leaps forward that Donruss had created in the 1992 and 93 sets. And again, the 94 set, for the most part, aesthetically, it's a pretty nice set. But by kind of neglecting the set in terms of print runs, and by focusing the effort on making sure that the Leaf and the studio sets were on par with some of the premium sets that other companies were making, Donruss took the eye off the ball with the base set. And we actually have some examples of that in the two packs that we opened up. And I made a point of this during the video break and pointed this out, first of all, with the Jeff Bagwell parallel card. So this is a parallel set. This is an insert card. This is a card that should be special. And this is also series two. Let's keep that in mind. This is a set. I don't recall the exact release dates of the series, but series one typically came out mid to late February, you know, right before spring training. Series two for most card sets was mid to late May. You wanted to get it out before the All-Star break, before people started thinking of football. And you released the second series then just to create enough interest to sell enough product and keep people buying baseball cards in the summer as opposed to shifting to football cards. So mid to late May 1994, these cards would have been released. Well, you look at that Jeff Bagwell card, and what stands out in 1994? Jeff Bagwell is pictured not only on the front, but on the back, wearing the old Tequila Sunrise Houston Astros uniform. Well, why is that such a big deal? Well, because in 1994, the Astros had a major overhaul with their uniform, with their logo, with their primary colors, totally ditching the rainbow look that had been a big part of their color scheme since 1975, and going for a more conservative dark blue and gold look. It incorporated the Houston Astrodome. That's right. The Astrodome was still an asset, not a liability for the Astros in 1994. And I think it's really one of the best uniform designs, often overlooked. People are gaga for the old rainbow look for the Astros. The Astros' current uniforms are very much taken from the guidebook for how the 1965 uniform was designed. But I think what the Astros wore from 1994 to 2000 is overlooked. And even though this parallel card, once you squint through the gold foil, acknowledges the logo change from 1994, here you have Jeff Bagwell, one of the young stars, a future Hall of Famer, who is featured in the old threads. Now, that is not a good thing. And it's not just for marketing purposes of the Houston Astros. You know, they're trying to get rid of the old rainbow uni look, and they're trying to move on to this more conservative look with the shooting gold star. But it looks bad on Donruss because the Astros were wearing these new uniforms in spring training. The Astros had these new uniforms on from opening day. So if Donruss was really aggressive, they could have sent out photographers to spring training or to opening day series to get the new Houston uniforms on these cards in series two. Series one, it's understandable because you're utilizing a lot of pictures from the previous season to get that set out before spring training. But by series two, there's really no excuse. And especially since the competition was doing that. You look at the cards being produced by Topps and by Upper Deck, especially the series two, the high series releases, they featured new uniforms, new logos. You had the new Astros, the new Texas Rangers look, the new Cleveland Indians look. And that is something that Donruss didn't have. In fact, I pointed it out to Mark Clear, who was a pitcher for the Indians. You had a picture of him in the old 1993 Indians uniform, as opposed to what the Indians unveiled in 1994, which was kind of a throwback to what they wore in 1954. So a lot of laziness by Donruss. And it's not just in terms of updating uniforms and logos. But one of the players we're going to talk about, Eddie Murray, is featured in Series 2 as a member of the New York Mets. Well, Eddie Murray was a free agent in the winter of 1993. He signed with the Indians in 1994. There's no reason not to have Eddie Murray, who even by 1994 you knew was going to be in the Hall of Fame, showing off his new duds. He should be in a Cleveland Indians uniform. There should be a Chief Wahoo logo on there, not the New York Mets. By May of 1994, Eddie Murray and the Mets, that was old news. He was doing good things in Cleveland. You know, forget about his time in New York City. So there was some laziness that was seeping into the base product. Even though it was a good, sharp set, even though there's a lot of stars in there, Donruss was really just kind of, you know, overseeing their own product. They were letting the focus on Leaf and Studio consume the base set, which is unfortunate. And then you have the factors that are outside of Donruss's control. Of course, 1994, not a big rookie card bonanza. in Major League Baseball. He had a lot of Derek Jeter cards showing up in 1993 sets by then. Chipper Jones and some other young studs, they had already made their debuts. Carlos Delgado, another one. You know, they were showing up in 1991 and 1992 sets. So you didn't really have the big splash rookie. Alex Rodriguez cards were still a year off. So 1994 was just one of those lulls in the rookie year, much like 1988 was. So that's out of their control. So there is no big splash rookie card in the 1994 set. And then, of course, you have the Major League Baseball strike. And 1994, as I've discussed before, a bellwether year for fans such as myself. I gave up on Major League Baseball for several years. And tying that strike along with the bloating of the hobby and kind of a lackluster rookie year, 1994 sets in general just did not live up to the expectations, didn't quite live up to the hype of some of the cards that were produced in, say, 91, 92, and 93. And all these years later, you know, what's propping up a 93 top set is the chase for the Derek Jeter cards, including the rookie gold cards, the Topps gold cards from 1993. And the same can be said for a lot of other sets that were released in 1992 or 93. There are two or three rookie cards that have become chase cards that keep those sets alive and keep their value up now. Whereas 1994, not so much. And that is definitely the case with Donruss. Now, here's the positive side to 1994 Donruss sets. While they had all of these bad things going against them, and it would eventually lead to the sale of Donruss to rival Pinnacle a couple years later, and then ultimately Pinnacle going bankrupt in 1998, pretty much, you know, the beginning of the death of Donruss in 1994, you can take advantage of that today, because a 1994 Donruss, my goodness, they are everywhere. And in fact, doing a quick eBay search, like Donruss Series 2, 1994 Series 2 packs, you can get two box lots for just $15. So you couple that in with $14 shipping and handling, you know, two boxes for $30, basically. Not a bad deal there. And again, with a 660 card set, you can very easily, if you get a couple boxes from Series 1 and Series 2, you're probably not spending more than $50-$60 on it. And you could very easily hand collate a set, maybe even two, out of a, you know, couple of two box lots. But let's remember the insert cards as well. You can end up with quite a few of those parallel sets. You can end up with the node to 1984 Donruss, and also the Diamond Kings. You may be able to, with a couple of two box lot purchases, may be able to complete or damn near complete the 94 Donruss Diamond Kings cards, which of course are always great, and especially with the glossy approach to it, making those Perez steel pieces really stand out. So if you're looking to scratch that 90s nostalgia itch, I present to you 1994 Donruss. This may be one of the best bargains. If you're looking to just throw it back almost 30 years ago, remember those quote-unquote good old days of 1994, if they were in fact good old days for you, and you can put together a set, you can open up some old packs, you can remember some of the great cards and the great players, and it will not cost you an arm and a leg. So if you can get two boxes of each for $15, two boxes of Series 2, and Series 1 is priced at about the same, I can tell you, you can probably find some sellers. And in fact, you could probably find some either a local card shop or at a card show, if you can safely go out to one of those these days. You could probably find someone who will sell you a box of Series 1 and a box of Series 2 for $15 a piece. And really, you know, what more can you ask for, right? For $30, you get a few hours of fun out of it. And even though there aren't huge rookies from 1994, much like with 1993, and I was just lauding about some of the players from 1993, man, you've got some incredible players in 1994. In the two packs that we open for the video break, you had Larry Walker, you had Jeff Bagwell, you had Don Mattingly, you had John Olerud was our Diamond King. You had three or four other Hall of Famers that were in this pack here. And that was just in two packs. Hall of Famers, or should be Hall of Famers, a couple of parallel cards here. I mean, a lot of star power here. What we didn't pull from the pack, but is also notable in the 1994 Donruss set, card number one is a Nolan Ryan career perspective card. He had retired after the 1993 season. What better player to lead off his set than Nolan frickin' Ryan? Also, Robin Yount, George Brett, two guys who had retired after 1993, so you have their final career cards. In the Diamond Kings card, they actually had a King of Kings, who was Dave Winfield. Now, when you say King of Kings, it sounds like something Pontius Pilate would bestow upon you. I don't quite see Dave Winfield as the second coming, but he was a pretty good baseball player. So, you've got some phenomenal players who had either wrapped up their careers or who were close to wrapping up their careers. Winfield is one. Paul Molitor is another. I believe Dale Murphy had wrapped his career before, with the Colorado Rockies. So, you've got some of the stalwart names from the late 70s and early 80s who are wrapping up their careers. You've got your Cal Ripken, your Lou Whitaker, your Jack Morris's, you name it. Ricky Henderson, he still had a few years left in him. So you've got some veterans. You've got some younger guys from the 1980s, your Gwynns, your Sandbergs, your Boggs, your Mattinglys. And then you've got some of the young stars from that time. Again, Bagwell, Walker, Glavin, Smoltz, I mean, you name it. It's just a phenomenal Griffey, Thomas, just so many names. Chipper Jones, so many names of phenomenal young players here. So, sure, it may not have that Topps Gold, Derek Jeter appeal to it, but you've got a lot of young stars, a lot of established stars, a lot of retiring, aging veterans, all in 660 cards. It is not difficult to complete a hand-collated 660-card set, especially if you buy a couple of boxes. So this is a great bargain. This is a great itch for that 90s nostalgia, that nice little scratch that you have for that, and it will not set you back. And it's a pretty good farewell, dare I say, to a solid set. The Donruss base set would go downhill for many years afterwards. Again, pretty much being a non-issue by the late 1990s. Panini reviving the brand several years ago, but certainly not the same thing. And I think it's a nice apex to a much-needed restructuring, rebranding, and remodeling of a base set that was getting kind of laughable in 1990 and 91. A much needed remodeling in 1992, a great step in 1993, and certainly equaling a lot of the premium and base sets that were created in 1994. But again, little axe oversight, not including pictures of players in their new uniforms and new logos. And by reducing the base set and focusing on the premium sets, even Donruss was by 1994 acknowledging, yeah, this isn't quite what it used to be. We've got to focus more on the high-end stuff as opposed to the brand that a lot of people were collecting and who enjoyed collecting, especially in the previous or for much of the previous 10 years. So there's our look at 1994 Donruss. That completes our look at the turning of the corner that Donruss made with some great sets in 1992, 1993, and 1994. Unfortunately for Donruss, not able to make that turning of the corner while striking a niche audience, a niche position, like Bowman did in 91, 92, 93 by becoming the card of the rookie card collector, the prospect chaser. Donruss upped the bar with the quality of their sets, certainly matched what everybody else was doing, but did not exceed what everybody else was doing, like Bowman did with the rookie cards, like Upper Deck would continue to do for many years before eventually getting edged out in exclusivity when Topps was able to lock that down in 2005 with Major League Baseball. So, Donruss was one of those brands that withered on the vine and died a slow, terrible death, much like many of the other cards that were being made in the mid to late 1990s. Now let's take a look at four of the cards that we pulled from the two packs here. Like I said, it just happened to work out where we had two pitchers and two hitters. And it also happened to work out that we had a couple of players who had lengthy careers, one a Hall of Fame career, and a couple of players who were seen as big prospects at the time. They had decent careers, but certainly did not, generally speaking, and I don't want to put these guys down, but generally speaking, did not live up to the hype of some of the other big rookies that were coming out at that same time. You know, certainly not of the same ilk as a Griffey or a Frank Thomas or a Chipper Jones. And Chipper Jones actually factors into rather nicely into one of the stories of one of these prospects. Not this one, although he was a teammate of Chipper Jones for many years in Atlanta, Ryan Klesko. And as I mentioned before, if you pulled a 94 Donruss Klesko card from your pack, it was probably worth 50 cents right out of the pack and would be seen as an up-and-coming young star. This was a guy that you wanted to have in your collection if you were a rookie collector. Ryan Klesko, born in Westminster, California. That's near the Los Angeles area, blue-collar community. Now, his father worked in the oil fields in Southern California, eventually would get divorced from his mother, and Klesko's mother was very influential in helping him and his sisters, and especially on the pitcher's mound. That's right, Ryan Klesko was scouted early and often as a pitcher, not as a first baseman or as an outfielder, as he would basically become once he got to the major leagues. Now, one reason why he became a standout pitcher, again, his mother, when he was 9 years old, his mother built a pitching mound on their property, and she acted as a catcher. She would put on the catcher's gear and help young Ryan and his sisters, who were two good softball players, become outstanding pitchers. Now, Klesko's mother not only helped him as a pitcher by building that pitcher's mound and by putting on the catcher's gear, she also, at a very young age, enrolled him in the Ron Lefebvre Pitching School. In fact, he was a student at that school for 8 years. So that's where it looked like he was going to be going. He was on the junior Olympic team for the United States at that time. However, in his later high school years, developed some arm trouble, some elbow trouble, ligament damage, and that pretty much shelved his pitching career. The good thing for Klesko is not only was he a good pitcher, he was also a very good hitter. So don't overlook his 138 strikeouts in 96 and two-thirds innings as a sophomore and junior in high school. Let's take a look at what he did as a batter as well. Managed to hit a mere 347 with five home runs and 18 RBI in his senior year in high school. And that certainly got the attention not only of major league clubs, but also of colleges. And the much renowned Arizona State University had signed Klesko. He had signed a letter of intent with him. However, the major league draft comes around, and the Atlanta Braves, who were visiting the LA Dodgers, were able to catch young Ryan Klesko with a batting practice tryout at the request of the Dodgers. So he takes batting practice. He is knocking the ball all over Dodger Stadium, which is not an easy thing to do, especially for a 17-year-old. And then all of a sudden, the Atlanta Braves are like, yeah, this guy's pretty good. So the Braves actually sign Klesko. So he foregoes the opportunity at Arizona State. He gets sent down to their Gulf Coast League team in Bradenton, Florida. And this is a great quote about Bradenton, Florida and the Gulf Coast League. This comes from Joel Ripple from the Sabre folks. We love the Society for American Baseball Research. He did a lot of the reporting here. I'm passing along this great quote about Bradenton. He says, I remember getting to Bradenton and it was hot as crap and hot and raining at the same time. So this would have been June or July of 1989. There were also these big mosquitoes. I went in and told the coach I hated it, was depressed, and wanted to go home. I said, how do I get out of here? He said, hit. So I did, and I was gone very quickly. End quote. I can attest, summertime in Florida, especially in Bradenton, and you know, Bradenton is pretty well developed now, but in the late 80s, still kind of a small bedroom community just south of the Tampa-St. Petersburg area. hot, muggy, lots of mosquitoes. Miserable time to be in Bradenton, the summer. Absolutely. I can totally feel what Klesko was feeling. So he gets out of Bradenton very quickly, and over the next few years moves up the Atlanta Braves farm system, is able to make his major league debut late in the 1992 season, makes his debut on September 12th of 1992. Doesn't have a whole lot to write home about, goes hitless in 14 at-bats over 13 games, starts the 1993 season in AAA at Richmond, but gets called up to Atlanta very quickly, makes his season debut on April 19th of 1993, 3 days later in Miami, gets his first major league hit, a pinch hit single off of Brian Harvey, who was the Marlins closer at that time. And then just a couple weeks later, April 27th, hits his first big league home run, a pinch hit two-run home run against Tim Wakefield, who was then with the Pittsburgh Pirates. For much of 1993, goes back and forth between Richmond and Atlanta, makes the opening day roster in 1994, and would basically be a big leaguer from then on out, other than the occasional minor league rehab stint. Now, even though Klesko was a much ballyhooed prospect, one of many in the Braves organization at this time, he did not get along with Bobby Cox, because Cox would platoon Klesko in numerous positions, mostly in the outfield. So you would have Dave Gallagher, Ron Gant, going, with Klesko. Gant would get injured early in the 94 season, so Klesko was able to take advantage of that. But often being platoon, Klesko wasn't able to put together some consistent numbers. But when he did get into a game, he would be rather effective. No more effective than the 1995 postseason. Had a phenomenal division series against Colorado, going 7-for-15 with an RBI. Didn't have much of an impact in the NLCS against Cincinnati that year, but had a very big impact against Cleveland in 1995, as he would become the first player to homer in three consecutive World Series games. In fact, his home run in Game 4, a 5-2 victory for Atlanta, landing just a few feet away from where his mother was sitting. So certainly returning the favor of his mother's hard work in the 1980s with that home run in Game 4 of the 1995 series. He homered in Games 3, 4, and 5. The Braves would wrap up a World Series championship in six games. First championship for Atlanta. In fact, the only championship for Atlanta since then. And the first championship for the Braves organization since 1957. Now, he would continue to be a pretty successful hitter in 1996, declined in his production in 1997, and had some injury issues, most notably an appendectomy in 1998. He would split time between the outfield and first base in 1999. Again, the platoon system for Bobby Cox, appearing in just 133 games. And even though Klesko was succeeding for the most part with Atlanta, he was expendable. And he was traded to the San Diego Padres along with Brett Boehm and prospect pitcher Jason Schiel to the Padres for Wally Joyner. Remember him? He was still playing then. Also Reggie Sanders and Kilvio Varas. Now, the good news for Klesko was he was able to shed the platoon tag and become a consistent player at first base, and was able to flourish under Bruce Bochy for many, many years. Although he was starting to deal with the numerous injury issues later on in his career, in the early 2000s, he did, however, have some notable, stretches of play there in the early 2000s. In fact, was leading the Padres in home runs in 2005, was able to help the Padres get to the playoffs in 2005, their first appearance since their World Series loss to the Yankees in 1998. And unfortunately, it was a short trip for the Padres after they got swept in the NLDS by the Cardinals. He was dealing with elbow soreness and shoulder soreness throughout the 2006 season. Was able to sign a contract with in 2007, I should say, with San Francisco, where he was reunited with Bruce Bochy, and he would wrap up his career following the 2007 season. 16 major league seasons, a career batting average of .279 with 278 home runs, and appeared in 1,736 regular season games. And he was also part of that 1995 World Series championship team. Now, what happened to Klesko after his retirement? Well, he became a little bit of a TV star, appeared on the Pursuit Channel on DirecTV in Campfire Stories. He is also a contributor to Atlanta Braves pre- and post-game television programs. He's also a real estate star as well, living in Macon, Georgia. Owns more than 7,000 acres of property across several states, and he also owns 17 rental homes. So it's not just Ryan Klesko, TV star and former Major League ball player, World Series champion. It is Ryan Klesko, slumlord. No, I shouldn't say that. he just owns rental properties. But a great story there with Ryan Klesko, who did he live up to some of the prognostications as to how good of a prospect he was? No, but he had a very productive career despite some lingering arm issues that go back to his high school years. But really a great story how his mother really championed him becoming a ball player, and not just any ball player, but a big league ball player as well. All right, now somebody who helped the Cardinals defeat the Padres in that 2005 NLDS would be a former Padre, that of course, Andy Benes. And Andy Benes was a pretty darn good pitcher who was the victim of a lack of run support, notably when he was with the Padres in the early 1990s. You know, there were some decent players on the early 1990s teams for the Padres, but just not a lot of offense there, and poor Andy Benes suffered because of that. But before we get to the end of his career, his time in the mid-2000s with the Cardinals would be that. Let's start from the beginning. Benes was born in Evansville, Indiana, basically grew up alongside Don Mattingly during this time, and he was a standout pitcher. In fact, he was part of the U.S. Olympic team that won gold in 1988. He was also a standout prior to that Olympic experience, I should say, at the University of Evansville. And he got drafted by the Padres and, in fact, was the first player selected in the 1988 amateur draft. Drafted by the Padres after that Olympic experience in the summer of 88, very quickly moved up through the Padres farm system and made his major league debut in the 1989 season, appearing in 10 games, starting all of them. Now, as I said, he had a pretty decent career or time with the Padres. You look at his stats, and his earned run average for many of those years, this is 1989 through 1994, or 95, I should say. Early on in his career, earned run average in the low to mid threes. It started creeping up closer to four later on in his career. But if you look through the splits of some of those first few years in San Diego, you could see he just didn't get the run support. In games where two or fewer runs were scored for the Padres, he lost quite a few of them. He was a guy who was a ground ball pitcher, would give up the odd home run every now and then, but a guy who would allow base runners and would allow maybe two to three runs to be scored against him. But again, the Padres weren't able to help him out offensively for many of those years. So his time in San Diego ends after the 1995 season, midway through the 95 season, I should say, as he was a trade deadline acquisition of the Seattle Mariners. He, along with Greg Kegel, who was the player to be named later, sent to Seattle for Mark Newfield and Ron Valone. This is just when the Padres were blowing everything up that they had in the early 90s. And he was part of the Mariners' drive in the playoffs in 1995. In fact, in a unique part of his career, Benes would give up the final home run of fellow Evansville native Don Mattingly. As that happened, I believe it was game two of the ALDS. and in Yankee Stadium, kind of the farewell tour for Don Mattingly. And, you know, Bennis was at the other end of that. So kind of neat. You know, you don't want to give up that postseason home run, but still, you know, he was part of that chapter in Mattingly's career as well. After the 95 season, as granted free agency, he would sign as a free agent acquisition in St. Louis, where, again, his earned run average was creeping up at this time. So now it's kind of closer to the fours in many of these years in St. Louis. But the Cardinals definitely had run support. You only had Mark McGwire at that time, right? As McGwire was bulking up at the plate. Even if Bennis gave up three or four runs, the Cardinals were able to take care of that as he won 18 games, a career best in 1996 with the Cardinals, following that with a 10-7 season and an impressive 3.10 earned run average, his third best in his career in 1997. Now, in 1998, he becomes a free agent, signs with the expansion Arizona Diamondbacks, is in the Diamondbacks record book as being the opening day pitcher for Game 1 against the Colorado Rockies, threw the first pitch in Diamondbacks history, and had a pretty decent start in 1998 at the age of 30, going 14-13 with a 3.97 earned run average. Would help the Diamondbacks make the playoffs in the wild card in 1999, despite a ballooning earned run average and a 13-12 record. He would find his way back in St. Louis as he signed as a free agent with the Cardinals in January of 2000, and that is where he would wrap up his career, playing a few more years with the Cardinals. You know, having some unimpressive years earned run average-wise, again, the Cardinals would bail him out often throughout much of those final few years there. So he was able to break even in the win-loss column. He was also able to get 2,000 strikeouts, just crossing that threshold in his career, in his final season, getting a grand total of 2,000 on the nose in his major league career. It was an honor for him to do that, not only because it's hard to get to 2,000 strikeouts, but also doing it as a member of the Cardinals, doing it at the old Busch Stadium. Bennis would say in an interview not too long ago that growing up in Evansville, the Cardinals were the closest major league team, so occasionally his family would come down to St. Louis and watch games in the old Busch Stadium, so that was quite the honor for him as well. Also an honor for Andy Bennis is during both stints with the Cardinals, he was able to play with his brother, Alan Bennis. So Alan Bennis, a member of the Cardinals from 1995 through 2001, so Andy Bennis with that opportunity from then on out. Now, in the summer of 2002, he would become a free agent again with the Cardinals, and then he would eventually wrap up his time with the Cards after that 2002 season, again with 2,000 strikeouts right on the nose, which is a pretty cool thing. Now, what is Andy Bennis doing these days? Well, he is the owner of the Junior Cardinals, which is a group of baseball players, a couple hundred baseball players who are young prospects, high school players, which is a pretty cool thing here. So he's continuing to commit to the game of baseball and also help out developing young players, not necessarily for the big leagues, but trying to develop them for success in high school and college as well. So that is what he has been doing ever since he hung it up following the 2002 season. He notes one of his highlights in his playing career was being named to the 1993 All-Star Game. Of course, he was with San Diego at the time, striking out Ken Griffey Jr. and Cal Ripken Jr. in that game. Now, remember, the 93 All-Star Game was in Baltimore, so striking out Ripken on his home field had to be a big thing there. He has mentioned that in that game, he faced eight players, six of them went to the Hall of Fame. So that is definitely a notch in your belt there. You definitely want that on your resume. So good to see that he is continuing to do well, helping young players get prepared for the next level of baseball while also staying active with the St. Louis community, the Cardinals community as well. And for somebody who grew up as a Cardinal fan, being able to do that Definitely something to be proud of. Now let's talk about Eddie Murray. Want to talk about Hall of Famers. This guy had such a phenomenal career. And I mentioned earlier, I think you can compare his career in many ways to the late Willie McCovey as somebody who was just generally speaking a pretty good person and was just a killer at the plate. This guy could mash like nobody else. First ballot Hall of Famer in 2003. Eddie Murray, the ninth of 12 children born in Los Angeles, growing up in Los Angeles in the mid-1960s. Quite the environment to grow up in, but he was able to play sandlot baseball, and he's often joked that it wasn't hard to pick the team, considering all of the children that were around him in his household. I said he was the ninth. I should correct myself. He was actually the eighth of 12 children. And was able to grow up playing Little League Baseball under Clifford Prelo, who was a former minor leaguer in the Dodger organization. And Prelo was a very big mentor for Murray. In fact, he honored him at his Hall of Fame speech in 2003. Murray would attend Locke High School in L.A. He was a teammate of Ozzie Smith. How cool is that? Murray and Smith on the same team in Los Angeles. Murray selected by the Baltimore Orioles in the third round of the 1973 amateur draft, very quickly moving up through the Orioles farm system, making his major league debut on April 7th, 1977, basically replacing Boog Powell. You know, Boog Powell had moved on to Cleveland prior to 1977. And boy, Murray was waiting in the wings, and did he deliver. American League Rookie of the Year in 1977, appearing in 160 games, hitting .283, 27 home runs, 88 RBI, 173 hits, and just a phenomenal start to his career. And he would be a mainstay in Baltimore through 1988. Would connect with another young shortstop, Cal Ripken Jr. He and Murray were close friends for a very, very long time. He won a World Series with the Orioles in 1983. Amazingly, Eddie Murray, despite some phenomenal numbers in Baltimore, never was an MVP. He kind of got shunned on a couple of those ballots, I have to say, when you look at the numbers there. As the Orioles were starting to tear things down in 1988, after a disastrous 1988 season, Murray would be on the move, traded to the Dodgers so he could play in front of the hometown crowd for Juan Bell, Brian Holton, and Ken Howell. I think the Dodgers got the better of that deal, although it was hard to tell at the time, because Murray struggled early on. Of course, part of it is adjusting to National League pitching and National League ballparks, hitting just .247, then a career low in 1989 with the Dodgers. He would rebound in 1990 and 1991, although he hit only .260 in 1991. He was still part of the National League All-Stars, a member of that team, the All-Star game in 1991. And after a rather stretch with the Dodgers, he was granted free agency following 1991. Now, I should mention, even though generally speaking, his time with the Dodgers was not good, he was absolutely robbed of an honor in 1990 through a technicality. Basically, Eddie Murray should have won the National League batting title in 1990. In fact, he was the lead hitter in all of Major League Baseball in 1990, but with the trade of Willie McGee from St. Louis to Oakland, McGee would win the National League batting title, even though, because he had enough plate appearances to qualify for it, even though he finished the season with Oakland, he did not do extremely well in Oakland. With St. Louis, McGee was hitting .335. He would hit .274 with the A's, so his overall season average was .324. But because he had enough plate appearances, the numbers in the National League stood. And Eddie Murray, despite finishing the season hitting .330, did not win the National League batting title. It went to Willie McGee. So again, a technicality gypping him of one of the few bright spots of his time with the Dodgers. Now, he would sign a two-year contract with the New York Mets heading into the 1992 season, part of a big free agent spending free frenzy that the Mets went on in 1992 that backfired tremendously And Eddie Murray was one of the few bright spots there. Hitting 261 in 1992, he managed to hit his 400th career home run, then one of the benchmarks for the Hall of Fame in 1992 against the Atlanta Braves. In 1993, he would hit for 285, continuing to pile on the home run list with 27 homers, and was just one of the few bright spots in an otherwise terrible New York Mets team, granted free agency following the 1993 season. So he signs with the Cleveland Indians, and he would turn out to be one of the veteran presences that would really rejuvenate the Indians. Of course, the Indians had a pretty good young core that was expected to do great things in 1994, and they did prior to the strike that shortened the 1994 season. Murray would be a pretty big factor in the success of the Indians in 1995. That was a season where he hit his 3,000th career hit. Happened in June 30th at the Metrodome against the Twins. He would be a great influence for the Indians, helping them throughout the 1995 playoffs, unfortunately falling flat a little bit in the World Series in terms of statistics, but helping the Indians reach the World Series for the first time since 1954. That's where they fell to Ryan Klusko and the Atlanta Braves. In 1996, he would split the 96 season between Indians and the Orioles, and had a nice little homecoming there with the O's, finishing up the season there in the playoffs as well, and also being a very positive impact for the O's in their return to the playoffs in the mid to late 90s. Murray would hit his 500th career home run in September of 1996, so he would join a very elite club, the 3,000 hit club plus 500 home run club. Then only Willie Mays and Hank Aaron were part of that club. Eventually, Rafael Palmeiro, Alex Rodriguez, and Albert Pujols would join that club, but of course, plenty of questions involving all three of those and their recreational activities that perhaps led to some of those home run numbers. Now, after the 1996 season, he goes back to Southern California, signs as a free agent with the Angels, plays in 55 games with the Angels, and then eventually signs with the Dodgers for a cup of coffee. And when it was all said and done, a phenomenal career, 287 batting average, 3,255 hits, 504 home runs, and 1,917 RBI. Now, after his playing career, he got into coaching for just a little bit. In fact, going back to the Cleveland Indians with that, as he would serve as the hitting coach for the Indians from 2002 through 2005, and would later be a hitting coach for the LA Dodgers. He got into a little trouble after his playing career as well. The Securities and Exchange Commission back in 2012, charging Murray with insider trading. Now, he was able to pay a fine to the SEC without admitting or denying any wrongdoing, with some alleged actions around a company called Abbott Laboratories. Supposedly, Murray got a hot tip from former teammate Doug DeCinces to, cash in on some stock options there. DeCinces would have to pay $2.5 million to settle the case. So Murray getting off a little easier with the $358,000 and change. Now, the Orioles have honored Eddie Murray with a statue in his hitting stance outside Oriole Park in August of 2012. And the Union Craft Brewery in Baltimore makes a wheat IPA nicknamed Steady Eddie. That was Eddie Murray's nickname throughout his career in Baltimore. Last but certainly not least, let's take a look at Todd Van Poppel, who is the poster boy of rookies who didn't quite live up to expectations, but he was also the recipient of some pretty bad career advice, and a lot of it came from his parents. And I think his story kind of dovetails along with the story of another phenom at the same time who got some bad career advice, had a pretty decent career, but had some bad career advice, and that's Eric Lindros, and I'll explain in just a moment. First, let's take a look at the story of Todd Van Poppel. We all know the baseball cards of Van Poppel, right? We know we've all had a few of those. We put those in lockdown cases back in the day. Well, Todd Van Poppel, born in Hinsdale, Illinois, he was a standout in high school in Arlington, Texas. He attended Martin High School in Arlington. As a senior, went 11-3, struck out 170 batters, had a 0.97 earned run average. So obviously, he is getting the attention of quite a few people. And one of the teams that he was getting attention from was the Atlanta Braves. Bobby Cox, the general manager of the team at that time. So this was 1990. And Cox is looking at the, you know, the young star out of Texas, as is every other team. And it turns out that the Atlanta Braves had their eye on Todd Van Poppel. Well, as the story goes, the Braves, through a couple of tips through some scouts, said, hey, you need to look at this kid from Jacksonville, Larry Jones. Of course, you know Larry Jones is Chipper Jones. And the Braves had done zero advanced scouting on Chipper Jones. They had no idea who he was. So a couple of scouts go down to Lakeland, where Jones is having a tryout for the Detroit Tigers. And the scouts can't get into the park. But as the story goes, from their car in the parking lot, they're listening to how the bat is coming off of Jones, or how the ball is coming off of Jones's bat. And they can tell this guy is just solidly hitting this ball. And they start thinking, well, wait a minute. Maybe Van Poppel isn't our guy here with the first overall pick. Maybe this Chipper Jones guy is. And the Braves were still interested in Van Poppel. But Van Poppel's parents made it clear to the Braves, if you draft him, we're not going to sign with you. We don't want to, you know, be with you. So the Braves not only get shunned by the Van Poppel family in terms of, you know, threatening to not sign if he gets drafted, but the Braves organization had arranged a couple of meetings with the Van Poppels to kind of feel them out a little more, to try to negotiate, try to, you know, change their minds. And the parents actually stiffed the Braves. They didn't show up for meetings that they were supposed to have. So obviously, this leaves a very bad taste in the mouth of the Atlanta Braves. And just a couple days before the draft, there's a legendary phone call where the Braves reach out to Chipper Jones' dad and inform them, hey, we intend on taking you with the first pick. And Chipper Jones' dad has to track down Chipper. Of course, this is before everybody had cell phones, basically tracked him down at his senior prom and, you know, said, you need to leave the prom and come back here. And of course, you know, his prom date was a little jilted over the whole situation. But that's how Chipper Jones became a member of the Atlanta Braves, not only because they were impressed with him, but because the Van Poppel family totally screwed over the Atlanta Braves scouts and management. And that leads to one of the many great what ifs. I discussed this earlier. Well, what if the Van Poppels were a little kinder and a little more open to the Atlanta Braves? And what if they decided to allow the Braves to draft Van Poppel first overall? You know, would he have been, you know, a better pitcher? Because when he got drafted by the A's with a 14th overall selection, the A's signed him to a pro contract. So they had some limited options on what they could do with him in the minor leagues. So he had very little experience in the minor leagues. In fact, I think he had, 32 minor league starts, which is just not enough. No matter how big of a prospect you are as a pitcher, you need some time in the minor leagues. You need, you know, far more than 32 games, at least a couple of years in most cases. And that's a great what if. Well, what if the Braves took Van Poppel? Where would Chipper Jones have gone? Because Jones was in demand. And, you know, how different would Van Poppel's career be? How different would Jones, you know, a Hall of Famer, where would his career be? Who would have the A's selected with the, you know, 14th overall pick? There's a lot of what ifs, which around amateur drafts are always fun to do with hindsight being 2020. You know, what if Dan Marino didn't fall so far down in the 1983 NFL draft? Aaron Rodgers in the 2005 NFL draft? What if the LA Kings drafted Luke Robitaille higher than they drafted Tom Glavine? You know, there's so many wonderful what-ifs. Sam Bowie and Michael Jordan. I mean, it goes on and on and on and on. And that's a great one, too. And it's just so sad to see that Van Poppel was steered in the wrong direction. I'm sure his parents probably had the best of intentions, but getting steered in the wrong direction to the point where, you know, he is, you know, bypassed by the Atlanta Braves. And you know, not only bypassed, but basically shunned by the Braves because he totally stiffs them. So, you know, I equate that to the Eric Lindros situation. If you're not familiar, Eric Lindros, the top amateur hockey player, also ironically in 1991, the Quebec Nordiques were the worst team. So they get the first overall pick. They were going to draft him, and you know, Eric Lindros's father said, if you draft him, he's not going to sign. So the Nordiques decided to throw all caution to the wind. They draft him. True enough, Lindros not only does not sign with the Nordiques, when he's drafted, he doesn't put the Nordiques jersey and hat on like most first round draft picks do at the NHL draft. So, you know, he eventually games a trade with the Philadelphia Flyers, and that trade, you know, the players and draft picks that went back and forth between those two teams basically built the foundation of the Colorado Avalanche and their two Stanley Cup wins in 1996 and 2001. So, you know, it's kind of similar where by stiffing the Braves, you know, Chipper Jones goes on to the Braves, wins a World Series in 95, goes on to the Hall of Fame. Van Poppel has a decent career, but certainly nothing that would have been at the level that Chipper Jones had. And, you know, Eric Lindros, you know, in the comparisons there, because again, some of the players that were involved, you know, Peter Forsberg went from the Flyers to the Avalanche. Some of the players that or went from the Flyers to the Nordiques. Some of the players that also were traded to the Nordiques were later traded to the Canadiens in the Patrick Waugh trade that, you know, ultimately set up the goaltending for the Avalanche for many years. So, you know, Lindros ends up as a Hall of Famer, but, you know, Van Poppel is not a Hall of Famer. He had a decent career. He would go on after, you know, having some ups and downs with the Athletics through 1996, would go on to play with Detroit, Texas, Pittsburgh, the Cubs, Texas again, and he would wrap up his career with the Cincinnati Reds in 2004. But he did so with a win-loss record of 40 wins and 52 losses, a 5.58 earned run average, and only 711 strikeouts. So what happened to Todd Van Poppel since then? Well, he got into some investments, which is definitely a good thing, some smart business moves. But he is also a coach for a baseball club called Impact Baseball Club Select. And that is a high-level travel league team in Texas. It bills itself as a Christian travel league team, so supposedly holding themselves up to high standards on and off the field. But what is also very interesting is that the Van Poppel name is not going to go away anytime soon, because Riley Van Poppel and Tate Van Poppel are both stars in Texas, not only on the baseball diamond, but also on the football field. Now, right now they're in high school, but they'll be heading to college very, very soon here. But the Van Poppel boys are starting to make inroads, and you have to wonder if some of the tough lessons learned by Todd Van Poppel, and especially in negotiating with professional teams and signing pro contracts a little too early, I wonder, and time will only tell, this will probably be another 5, 6, 7 years, but I wonder if some of the lessons that were learned through his experience will be reciprocated in his kids' experience, and hopefully one or both of them will have lengthier times in professional sports than he did. So we look at the Todd Van Poppel cards, and we laugh, and we moan, and we kind of look up at the sky, because we all remember pulling those cards and thinking, hey, this is the next big rookie card, right? Remember those around 1991? We started pulling those up. Yeah. Even though we kind of moan and groan and roll our eyes at the Todd Van Poppel cards, the Van Poppel name, keep an eye out for it, because Riley and Tate are standouts in both football and baseball, and they're playing on these high-level travel leagues that often get noticed by scouts, not only collegiate but pro. So I'm sure you'll hear some Van Poppel news again over the next few years as how they progress throughout high school. And if they go the collegiate route through college. So that's our look at some of the cards from the 1994 Donruss set. Again, an outstanding set in terms of design, affordability nowadays, also collectability. It's 660 cards if you're not including the various inserts and parallel cards. So an easy card to collect. You're not going to pay any bills by collecting this set. This is strictly a 90s nostalgia scratcher. That's it. You're looking to, you know, you're looking to basically just fill that need of going back into the 1990s. You can do that with 94 Donruss, and you can do it rather cheaply, but with a pretty solid set in terms of design. And on top of that, again, the star power. There's not that big fish rookie card that's in there, but you will find some legendary veterans, some Hall of Fame established stars, and some young stars, including some Hall of Famers, that are in that set. We pulled quite a few good ones just in two packs of Series 2. I can only imagine what you'll get if you buy a couple of boxes and try to pull the set together yourself. All right, so that's our final look at the 90s nostalgia via Donruss, the 1992, 93, and 94 sets. Again, our next show, we're going to be looking through a different type of nostalgia, the nostalgia of opening up a wax pack and finding what stars and rookies from vintage years, 60s through the 80s, through repacked wax. So Ryan Cornell will join us on our next podcast. That is Friday, February the 26th. We will do that then. And don't forget, we've got some other exciting topics and shows coming up throughout the next few months. Follow us on Twitter at Wax and Gum Stains. Make your cardboard donations by emailing me, MattSalmonSays, it's S-E-Z, at gmail.com. Give us a follow on YouTube as well. Subscribe to Wax Ecstatic. And if you have a cash donation, you can do that too at paypal.me/WaxEcstatic. We take all suggestions, comments, questions, thoughts at Wax and Gum Stains. So if you have a show idea, send it my way. I'm always open to revisiting certain sets or taking a look at some sets that perhaps we haven't looked at before, or haven't looked at deep enough. Don't forget, wear those masks, wash those hands, stay socially distant, not too far, just 6 feet. Wave hello to your friend and continue our fight against the coronavirus. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks for listening to Wax Ecstatic. We will see you next time.
There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19.
Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this podcast.